Boundary of contract with annual reporting and repricing mechanism. Roberta?
Thank you, Martin. So agenda paper 2 discusses how to determine the boundary of some insurance contracts that are guaranteed to be renewable every year with no further underwriting of the individual policyholder. The submission we received describes the feature of two insurance contracts. For the first contract, which is referred to as step-rated insurance contract, every year the insurer can reset the premiums based on tables with premiums that increase with the increase in the age of the policyholders. The second contract, which is referred to as participating contract, has an insurance component similar to the first contract and a unit-linked investment component. The premiums paid by the policyholders are accumulated in an account from which the insurers deduct the fees for the insurance coverage and the fees for the management of the asset held in the unit-linked fund. Similarly to the first contract, every year the insurer can reset the fees based on step-rated fee tables. So the submission asks whether those contracts would have a contract boundary of 1 year or longer than 1 year, given that annually the insurer can reprice the contract to reflect reassessed risk of the portfolio. The submission notes that there are mixed views on the determination of the contract boundary, which are summarized in paragraph 16 of the paper. Some think that the pricing does take into account risks that relate to periods after the repricing date when applying paragraph 34B, subparagraph 2 of IFRS 17, and that therefore the contract has a boundary longer than 1 year. Others have the opposite view. So in the staff analysis, we note that the risks to be considered for the assessment are the policyholder risk in the portfolio, rather than any wider risk to which an entity might be exposed or might consider while pricing the contract. And for the contracts described in the submission, our view is that the pricing does not take into account risks that relate to periods after the repricing date. This is because the insurer set premiums reflecting the risks that result from the actual age of a policyholder for the year of coverage, rather than level premiums over the expected lifetime of the contract. And the annual premium for a new policyholder is the same as the annual premium for an existing policyholder with the same age. So the contract would have a boundary of 1 year. So we would like to get your views on the accounting analysis set out in the paper.
Leslie?
Thank you. At the Canadian Accounting Standards Board meeting, this topic was discussed, and there was general disagreement with the view of the staff for the reason that when no underwriting is required, the fact that the renewal is guaranteed confers value to the policyholder. So, in fact, the mere fact that the premium is the same for the attained age does not mean it doesn't include those future risks, because it includes the risk of having to renew somebody who has deteriorated in health.
Who was next, then?
This is a very topical discussion point in Australia, so it did receive quite a bit of time at the Australian TRG. As you would expect, their members were pretty comfortable with the findings and thought it was a logical and sensible paper. They did say that, you know, they would agree with the example provided, but it did seem to be very, very narrow. In that it did assume that the 40-year-old policyholder had the same standard health as the new entrant. So they did say that they could see in practice you wouldn't necessarily always get this short contract boundary, because there were products that would be dissimilar and therefore push that boundary out. They did particularly note that it was very helpful to have a clarification around the risk type that you take into account, the repricing, and that was insurance risk or policyholder risk. I thought that was very helpful, because there are a number of products in our market for which this has been interpreted, and it was good to have the clarification set out in the paper. a number of people did comment that there were some very sensible wordings in the 2013 exposure draft around the inclusion of risk or the use of risk in determining the rights to reprice. Where it says an entity shall determine the boundary of an insurance contract by considering all the substantive rights that are held by the policyholder, whether they arise from a contract, law, or regulation. And they noted that had disappeared from the 2013 ED. We're not sure why it went, but they said it would actually be quite sensible to put something like that back in to clarify the position around risk. But alternatively, you could put just the words insurance risk in the paragraph 34B. That would be an alternative. The other topic that came up was relating this to the APO4, which we're going to talk about later, and how some of the implications around this really have a knock-on effect in terms of how long a boundary you're looking at for the acquisition costs. And so that was considered a significant topic. We'll get to that later.
Just the point of clarification that the words you were regretting were not in the paragraph have been moved up to the beginning,
right.
So they're in paragraph two, so they cover the whole standard.
Thanks for that.
Thank you, Martin. Let me add to that discussion. Yeah. From a purely technical perspective, yeah, and in the very narrow example provided, the staff recommendation is understandable. However, in practice, the assessment is not as clear-cut, and therefore care must be exercised when providing too detailed guidance, yeah, on the assessment of contract boundaries. There need to be room for interpretation in this principle-based standard. We have some observations and questions here in the following. Firstly, the distinction between level premium and step premium in reality is not that rigid, yeah, because there could be hybrid forms apply. Yeah. How should an insurer account for a hybrid form of a level and step premium as some, but not all the future risks are included in pricing? Second, the paper mentioned lower D discount, and depending on the fact and circumstances, the conclusion could be different, yeah. And there are many variations of such loyalty discount in practice. Yeah. There are some loyalty bonuses. Another example is our AIA Vitality Program, which empower and motivate the customer to take better care of their health by incentivizing positive lifestyle choices. So you can have many such examples. And thirdly, in practice, the pricing often differentiate between a new 40-year-old policyholder compared to an existing policyholder. And I mentioned one reason could be the loyalty discount here. Another reason could be the fact that the existing policyholder may have some existing conditions that develop after the contract have been issued. Paragraph 20 referred to the policyholder obtaining something of value. In the policyholder that has been with an insurer for many years obtains the right that he or she does not have to be underwritten individually as opposed to a new policyholder of the same age. This can be something of great value and should be taken into account in the assessment. Another example is products that have a maximum renewal age significantly higher than the maximum issue age. For example, a product that have maximum renewal age at 100, where the maximum issue age is 65. In such a product, the existing policyholder, an existing policyholder age 70, has a substantive right here to renew the coverage until age 100. And there's no new policyholder will be admitted from age 65. So that's, I think, need to be, that those kind of fact pattern that should be considered. Yeah. And lastly, it seems very odd to me that, only policyholder risk is considered, as mentioned in the paragraph here. Yeah. Because in reality, multiple risks are present in the contract. And These include the expense and lapse risk. How was the conclusion in paragraph 19 arrived at there? Therefore, our view is that the view one is the correct reflection of the economics of the contract because all the risks should be taken into account.
Okay, that's a different view. Maybe?
Yeah. I think I basically share what the main points of Sai Zhong points. And generally, but I have to say that I agree with the staff's view that the contract boundary is 1 year for both contracts claimed in this example. The staff believe that paragraph 34BI is met because the entity is seen to be able to reassess the risks of the collective and can set a price that fully reflects the risks of the collective. So the staff believe that all premium charges of subsequent years are outside the contract boundary. However, to determine the contract boundary for specific products, I think that judgment has to be made case by case. Under step-rated health insurance products in the example, the premium for a new 40-year-old policyholder would be the same for an existing 40-year-old policyholder, just assuming that they are both in standard health condition when they buy the contracts. Under Korean renewable health insurance products, the premium for a new 40-year-old policyholder would also be the same as the premium for an existing 40-year-old policyholder if the new policyholder is in standard health. In this respect, these Korean products have some similarities to the step-rated insurance products explained in the example. But at renewal date, the existing policyholder who was initially in standard health can renew the contract even though he is no longer in standard health. For example, while a new policyholder who has a cancer cannot buy the same health insurance product through underwriting, the existing policyholder who later gets cancer after inception can renew the contract without further underwriting. The difference in these circumstances can be seen as after the first period of coverage, the policyholder has obtained something of value, as described in BC 162A. I want to check whether this statement is true, even though premium for this product is priced collectively based on the step-rated table reflecting age risk. I think this is a common thought that Sai Zhongfeng said, I think. That's why I believe the contract boundary for these renewable health insurance is not ended. Again, determining contract boundary varies depending on the features embedded in products, so the decision requires careful considerations. Lastly, I would like to point out that if there are some limitations to the premium adjustment clause, it might have different outcomes regarding contract boundary. Accordingly, if those limitations exist, the subsequent premiums might be within the contract boundary. So we need to be very careful when deciding the contract boundary issues. We need to consider different types of features and products, I think. Thank you.
So I actually had a question for Leslie, just to start off with. You talked about the Canadian board and where they got to, and I just wanted to understand whether they got there in interpreting 34A, which I think if you're looking just at 34A, which deals with the individual policyholder, it's clear because the individual policyholder is not re-underwritten, they clearly have a substantial right.
No, so it's 34B. It's actually exactly the same point that JP just made. He made it a little more eloquently than I did, but it's exactly the same point, that it's 34B2.
And then if you read paragraph, how did you read what would be paragraph 12F, which essentially says the entity can reprice the contract annually at a portfolio level, and that repricing can involve creating new step tables for that portfolio.
Yeah.
Because that seems to me what the entity is doing in that circumstance is right, they are actually able to. It's if they were applying an existing or a generic step table, and I think that might be where you were coming from, JP, and yours. Then I can see how that is irrelevant to the risk of the particular portfolio. But if they are repricing that particular portfolio, That seems to me that you're recreating a one, and I wondered if that part of the fact set
is almost throwing everybody. Yes, no, in Canada, it's obviously, it's always a generic step table that you are repricing. Okay, so that is a different...
I think that's what the submitter was getting at, and I think perhaps comes back to side point, but we really need to be careful about examples because you tend to filter them through your own
through what we are used to. Yeah, we have to have generic tables. So I understand if there were specific new step rated tables for that portfolio, that might be a different situation. Thank you.
Francesco.
Thank you. I conclude that the view one would be the appropriate one for both contracts, so a long boundary. I believe that the fact pattern is quite clearly in my mind indicating that the assessment of the risk for the policyholder is beyond the assessment date. The fact that the insurance company is prepared to accept members of this portfolio to develop significantly costly medical conditions without re-underwriting them has to be reflected in the pricing. The fact that they have chosen a table that is calibrated to the age of entry of the policy holders is just a mechanical choice, but the substance of those numbers within the table is effectively the one of a level premium. And I can tell you that the submission says that the table is rewritten. Effectively, the old table is gone and a new table is introduced, but for the same community policy holders, not specifically to a particular section of policyholders. So there's no point.
I think that then becomes an important distinction that we need to be very clear on because I think my point here is I think you would get to different answers depending as we just discussed.
So there's only one table for all the members of the community that are rated in that particular product, and when it's changed because of the practical ability to reprice, the old table is gone and the new one comes in. Because they have reassessed the risk, the policyholder risks that experience have been telling them is emerging from the policyholders that become part of the policyholder portfolio up until that point in time. And then, given that experience, they readjust the table so that the new ones, when they come in, they will be paying the new price that has been set at that point. But the price is also the one that the existing policyholders will continue to pay if they want to remain in that group of policyholders that make the portfolio. So the uniformity of pricing applied to existing and new policyholders, and the fact that there is only a single table for the product is a critical fact pattern that the submission made clear.
So I think we've got to be very careful with the fact pattern here, because I think, Sai, you were pointing out the same thing to a certain extent. There are very specific nuances that we need to be aware of, or that we need to be aware of in anything we publish, I think.
Kevin?
Martin, I wanted to talk about the second example with the unit linking features. I'm not sure if you want to finish off on the other one first and come back to me or want to take it now, and if any of the other comments are on the same example.
Any specific on the first?
Yeah, it's on the first. Actually, I wanted to clarify something on the fact pattern because this is what slightly confused me based on how it is written in the fact pattern and how the conclusions is drawn afterwards. And this is in the appendix, say, paragraph 5 and 8. So paragraph 5 says that premium rates are generally calculated with a competitive position and a smooth progression of rates. So how do you interpret that, or what was meant here? Because you may be progressing the rates, but if for whatever reason, let's say certain cancers are age-related and the risk of them increases higher after, let's say, the age of 45, however, you do not want to have a jump in the rates between age 40 and, let's say, 45 and 46, and therefore you are still changing the rate. It's a step rate year on year, but you are smoothing that increase, in which case you will be bringing future risk, isn't it? Or similarly, paragraph 8 says that the pricing process is typically iterative, as the premium rates at older ages affect the expected lifetime profit value of policies sold at younger ages. So this made me, at least that's how I read it, that there are some risks associated with the future that are factored into the pricing. So that was the confusing bit for me.
It's a hybrid example.
Mm. Yeah.
So the smooth.
Examples are difficult. Gail.
Yes,
We had agreed with the staff analysis, and when we had debated it, we had come to the same conclusion that this was a short boundary. And I was slightly concerned with a couple, maybe it's because of this point that I hadn't appreciated, because a couple of people said because the 40-year-old has got cancer, that the existing and the new one hadn't. I don't think that is relevant in the analysis. So that's why I was slightly concerned, if you're pricing the portfolio as a whole. So that's why I was slightly concerned with that. The bit that I thought the paper was helpful and the long debate we have had is what risk are you repricing? So I think that is helpful to make it clear it's insurance risk or policyholder risk, not the lapse risk, expense risk, all the other because that is, I think, quite helpful, and that had been an area of lack of clarity. This whole boundary bit, we have such a fine line between the health and the life contract, so we just need to be really careful because it's so easy to cause a problem somewhere else.
Thanks, Gail.
So it links closely to the point that Gail was making, so the clarity about the risk that you consider when looking at the contract boundary being the policyholder risk. I think that the paper makes it quite clear. What I'm not entirely sure about is whether you can also think about other risks related to the policyholder, so maybe financial risk. And in paragraph 25 of the paper, where you talk about the unit-linked example, essentially it has the same step-rated insurance coverage, but it's also got a unit linking feature. It says, the fact that the entity automatically reprices the investment component via the unit linking feature, i.e., you know, the charge is a percentage of the unit value, is neutral in establishing if the requirements of paragraph 34B of IFRS 17 are met. So it's basically saying, you know, don't think about the fact that your 3% annual management charge goes up and down because the value of the assets goes up and down. But what if you could change the 3%, or you were limited from ever changing the 3%, or maybe you could charge a maximum of 3%? Would we take that into account?
Different fact pattern, that's a good question. Laurent?
So I agree that the clarification on what is in the scope of policyholder risk is useful, and I agree with one comment in the paper, which is that if we were to include lapse and expense risk in the definition, I think we would end up with many businesses having long boundaries. We'll be discussing later on some adaptation on the insurance topic, we'll be saying that some paragraphs of IFRS 17 need to be seen from the perspective of the student. To that extent, I would suggest that perhaps we have the flexibility of recognizing that insurance companies could themselves be policyholders and to insure themselves, for instance, against lapse risks. So to that extent, that should fall into the scope of what policyholder risks are. Then I think the discussion on the example is extremely useful because personally when I first read the example I agreed with the conclusion on the short boundaries, but then there are plenty of nuances. We are seeing in the appendix that as we discuss in paragraph 5 there could be some smoothing of the pointing out at some kind of labeling. It is also mentioned that there might be clawbacks in the product. It is also specified that there could be some loyalty discounts which would give an incentive to the policyholder to renew. So for me, the danger we have is to have, out of this example, perhaps some new general conclusions. So I think it's a good one, but it's also a good warning, and we should not jump too directly to the conclusions.
Mm-hmm. Roman?
Yeah, I wanted to add to Kevin's point on the unit-linked component. I think here I have difficulties to really read the fact pattern in a clear way. And it's unclear for me what neutral should be. So clearly, going back to the policyholder risk, I would say policyholder risk is not only insurance risk. Otherwise, I have certain contracts, maybe investment contracts with DPF, what is the contract boundary for such a contract where there's no insurance risk. So there must be more than insurance risk only. And I have difficulties to see why it should be neutral. So In that case, I think all unit link contracts would be then only short duration. So yeah, there is, I think, this automatic change of the absolute fee because the fair value is changing. It's not a repricing from my perspective, because a repricing would be for a unit link contract based back on Kevin's example. If I can change the fee based on certain developments, percentage up and down, maybe there's an upper limit or a down limit, there's a range, different fee structures are possible, but that would be a kind of repricing. But if this is fixed right from the beginning, I would not see the change of the absolute fee because the underlying items are changing in their fair value as a contract on the way.
Okay, Leslie?
We had the same question about the financial risk, and not just in the unit link, but in the step-rated premiums as well, because when you are doing a pricing, you look to the financial risk further than 1 year, because you think the people are going to be renewing. That's the way you look at the pricing. So you are taking into account risks in the future period in setting your prices. So I think it is analogous. It's not just on the unit linked. There was another minor comment made and wondered why you used the term policyholder risk instead of insurance risk, if that's what you meant, because surely lapse risk is a policyholder risk. It was confusing to some people what you were trying to exclude. And the two aspects were lapse and expense risk and financial risk.
Okay.
Yeah, let's say I agree with what Kevin and Roma said in the sense that I follow the fact pattern quite well in the example number one. In the example number two, it's still a little bit difficult to follow the conclusion on the contract boundaries. Probably what would be interesting to understand in this specific example is how also the policyholder is paying the premiums related to the unit link part. If it's a voluntary payment and based on the payments is able to acquire some units, in that case probably I tend to agree with the example. But let's say the danger that I see is to draw a general conclusion on the unit link based on this concept of the neutrality with reference to the contract boundaries. I guess that it's a little bit dangerous considering that unit link can have different features, and so I would put the attention on the specific contract rather than getting conclusion on the overall unit link part.
Okay, and this demonstrate if we conclude on one example and then have implications on slightly different example is always difficult, and we should take that in all the kind of examples into account. That was also my word at the beginning. I think that is always difficult, and therefore I think it's the general reason why we like principle based and not really rules based, because then you have all these kind of questions. If you don't have any further comments to that, I would ask Roberta if you have learned something
from this
discussion and summarize it.
Yeah, I think that the purpose of the paper is to explain what we mean for risk in paragraph 54b. I think that the paper wants to clarify that these are the policyholder risk, and some of you observed that policyholder risk certainly include the insurance risk. And some of you even question if the financial risk might be considered also a policyholder risk. So I think that is also very clear that when we try to change the fact pattern in the submission, the conclusion might be different because there are other factors to consider. So I think that the example that were included in the paper were intended to explain this concept of what policyholder risk means in that paragraph. The intention was not to use this example to conclude on different products that are in the market. So if you agree, I would just reporting the summary. The intention is to clarify that risks in the paragraph 34B means policy or the risk, being including the insurance risk.
Harry, do you want to say something?
And I agree with what you've just said.
It's the main takeaway.
And I may look to Sue here for some past experience with. So I think the one concern that I would have with it is I think what we've indicated here is some different views in the way people read the example. And I wonder if we don't need to make that statement in a conclusion, because if I were doing this, I'd look at the conclusion and then I'd go pick up the paper, and I, if I'm reading the paper in the different ways. So I think we might just need to say that we discussed the example and we believe that the example could be interpreted a number of different ways. Therefore, we don't consider the example a relevant to understanding the conclusions that we arrived at.
But can we not make it any more useful in terms of drawing more specifically on the clarifications around the fact pattern in the discussion, where there was a specific repricing that took into account the portfolio risk and fully reflected, etc., that, you know, to support the conclusion? Because otherwise it's going to be a fairly bland statement, and I'm not sure that it's going to be super helpful for anybody.
What we can include in the summary, maybe that might be helpful, that in this specific fact pattern, we had a health check at the beginning of the contract, and then the fact pattern says that the insurer is able to learn from the experience of this portfolio and reprice to reflect this experience based on a portfolio, and this is why we came to a certain conclusion. It might be different that if we have a general pricing mechanism that does not look through to that experience of a portfolio, would that we get to
what that paragraph F, the way we would, or the way staff interpreted paragraph F might be.
Yes.
Members of this panel, certainly me, have concluded differently to others by starting from the same pattern you just described, Hagit.
So again, I think that if we
I think we have a division here. That there is no consensus.
No, I think
it doesn't matter. You said it doesn't matter, but just to reflect what it is.
Is the different view, though? I think, and I just want to clarify this. Then I think we all read paragraph F I referred to, and we read it in slightly different ways. Now, you read it bringing the knowledge of your knowledge of that type of product, as did Leslie. And in the context there, if it's a general repricing mechanism that's updated from time to time, then I think we would probably agree as a group that, in fact, that is longer than 1 year. Yeah. On the other hand, if it's
we'll put a distinction between a general repricing and a repricing that looks at the experience in the portfolio and reflects that risk in the repricing.
Can I ask for one clarification there, though? The word portfolio.
Sorry?
The word portfolio is a little disturbing there, because the portfolio is quite broad in that term. So in my view, the general repricing mechanism does apply to the entire portfolio, just not specific groups or specific contracts within the portfolio. So that is, I'm still now hearing Gail and Francesco say different things. I manage my YRT universal life contracts in one portfolio, and I have a general repricing mechanism. So I still think JP's and my point is valid there.
To me, at least, the principle that we looked at when we look at contract boundaries, so if you remember, we started this with having just the first paragraph about repricing based on re-examining the risk of the policyholder, and then a second paragraph in the, you know, development of the standard was added to address the ability of the entity to react to the changes in the risk of that specific portfolio that it managed. So, for example, if I take two extremes, one of them, if you'll say this is a life contract and I generally reprice by, you know, those general mortality tables that apply to everyone, this is clearly an example for me. You say, if you disagree, that this is a general repricing without looking through the experience that you gather. But if you look at health contracts, some of the examples, you actually learn a lot from the claims, and then you can use this information to reprice that portfolio. So this would be an example of the, I think, towards the other.
Again, the word portfolio there is sticking me.
Contract boundary is a portfolio assessment. Yes. In the standard, a contract boundary is a portfolio assessment. So I think portfolio is what was intended.
I think all of it suggests that we have to be incredibly specific about how we've interpreted that paragraph F, and then we need to make that statement in the conclusion. Mm-hmm. And I think almost you want to be, again, we're giving guidance here. We're not trying to draw the line. I think we need to be almost overly specific. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about repricing the portfolio for the emergence of risk within that portfolio. And I think if we are that specific, I think we're providing useful guidance here. And then we can go further and say, but, and I think this is the point that's been made around the table, that a number of people around the table noted that there are nuances. And that you very quickly move to community pricing or something like that that moves you out. I think that's useful.
The other thing that I think is helpful is the comments about the policyholder risk, and to the point about what does policyholder risk mean. It means the risk specific to policyholders, so excludes lapse and expense rate, but includes.
What about financial?
It includes the
insurance risk and financial risk.
It includes
because
financial
they are both
risk.
As we transfer from the insurer to the
policyholder to the insurer.
But policyholders do exercise lapse behavior, so lapse risk is a substantial risk to consider.
The risk of the insurer, not of the policyholder. The policyholder does not suffer lapse risk. So it's not a risk that's transferred from the policyholder.
Well, there can be many products whereby the economic substance is affected significantly by lapse behavior. If you look at the paragraph 34B1, there are two distinctions here. One is, when you say reassess the risk, it's a plural. And it say, at the end, it say fully reflect the risk of that portfolio, it become a singular. It seems to encompass much more than a narrow sense of a risk there.
I think how staff is reading 34B is reading it in concurrent 34A. 34A is clearly policy for the risk. And 34B is an extension by that, by taking from just an individual assessment to a portfolio assessment. So it can't be suddenly a different risk when we switch from the individual to a portfolio.
And that hadn't been read necessarily.
It hadn't read, and it's not specifically stated, but I think what we're trying to see is this is,
the outcome of including all sorts of risks or, potential renewals, even if the option is not there, obviously is considered in pricing. So the outcome of a very wide interpretation would mean that the contract boundaries are very long for all contracts, which is something missing the point of those requirements.
I would suggest that we summarize it in that way, and then we maybe, if you have still concerns, that in the next meeting we take it up, because if we now, as in discuss it further, we're too far on the fact pattern and confusing it even more.
Just the unit link discussion, I've not heard in the summary brought up by Kevin myself, so either we.
And the unit link, my summary of that was, okay, there could be circumstances which are not in this fact pattern, which can influence, but this was not discussed and not concluded in detail. I think that would be a different kind of submission, but I think we are not in the stage now prepared to can discuss it today and conclude on that. And if that is still an issue, I think we should then maybe have a further submission and clarifying that, because on the fly it is always difficult then to say. Would you agree to that?
Yeah, probably only if I made the statement that the unit link component is always priced based on fair value of underlying items. It seems too general, so I don't know.
That was clarified. That is too general. We said, okay, that is okay. Last word to Francesco.
Just on this policy, all the risk and the last risk that Sai-Chung just raised. Whenever you accept a customer, you don't only look at how healthy or not he or she may be, but you also look at what is the propensity of that person to stay with the contractor for longer or shorter periods. So it's really hard for me not to agree with Sai-Chung saying that's actually a characteristic for the policyholder. How can you say that simply because this risk arises from the fact that I've entered into the contract, that suddenly then is not a policyholder risk? We call it policyholder behavior. It's really counterintuitive. So if you can help us really rationalize, because at the moment I'm with Sai-Chung, I don't really see how you can exclude lapse risk from
bonus yeah, risk. That, yeah, you know, you're looking at the examples given, you know, you mentioned loyalty discount. Loyalty exactly. discount imply
a policy of the behavior.
Behavior, yeah. So that need to be considered, yes.
Certainly a risk that gets taken into account, obviously, but I think that what about the response that Joanna gave, which I think is the sort of logic that's been used in the analysis in the paper, that 34A focused on that type of risk and 34B is just an extension to that same logic in a portfolio setting. Because I think we have to be careful of unintended consequences. If we start looking at it very broadly, nothing's going to have a shorter bound.
No, I appreciate it, but then where did you draw the line? A behavior is also that I buy the policy, I'm not a smoker, then my behavior changes, I become a smoker. So, but that would be insurance risk. So why is the behavior changing my habits okay, instead of the behavior of deciding whether I want to keep the policy or not okay? So that's where it becomes really... strange.
The thing is that lapse risk, persistency risk, expense risk doesn't make a contract an insurance contract. So this is specific for insurance contracts.
Neither financial risk, but financial risk is okay.
Because I think it's more similar in the sense that it's risk that's transferred from the policyholder to the entity that the policyholder has. It's specific risk that the policyholder has that's transferred to the entity, and that's what makes it different.
But financial risk is not specific to either party, but yet you said it's okay. So again, I'm really confused by what is
transfer of risk.
Yeah, fine. And we are creating risk instead of transfer risk, but this is a risk which is specific to the policyholder.
Yeah, but the lapse risk is clearly not transferred from the policyholder to the entity.
It doesn't exist before the contract. Yeah.
Is this risk specific to the contract, but not a transfer?
The policyholder cannot suffer a loss because of lapse or condition.
You know, how do you price for loyalty discount if you don't consider persistency?
That's a measurement issue, though, not a contract boundary.
It's a measurement, but also is an assessment of the risk, because the risk is the result of certain cash outflows being incurred before certain inflows being received, and the key driver to assess what is the net outcome of the measurement is really the risk assessment and the definition of the probability of inflows and outflows. And one of the key elements, if not the most important one after insurance risk, is policyholder behavior. And really, find it really difficult to say, well, that one, which is actually specific to a party to the contract, is excluded because it is their party that creates it. When in fact, when the pricing and the boundary is all about that, and insurance risk.
Mary?
I would be really concerned about reopening this.
Yeah.
And because this was debated at length with representations from the industry, I think we've had a helpful summary that clarifies the interpretation of paragraph 34A and B. I would not see.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. And as I repeat, we'll write the summary if you still have problems, okay, then we have still the chance, okay, at the next meeting to discuss it again. We are a little bit ahead of time, so I would say we have now a break and come